So welcome everyone to the Physio Matters talk. This is the title of the discussion, which is the diversity and inclusion in physiotherapy, the past, the present, and the future. And as you can see, I have an all-star lineup, as we've always been tweeting around, an all-star lineup of panelists that are here to give experiences and share their thoughts on a multitude of topics that we have prepared for today. Now, I think it was important for me to clarify it. Like, one of the things with diversity and inclusion is that there are multiple aspects of diversity and inclusion. There you have the racial aspect, you have the ethnicity side, you have the LGBTQ side, you have the disability side. But just for the purpose of this particular talk, we will be focusing on our ethnicity sides and our shared experiences, which is what I think we have more expertise on and we can really talk through. Now, we'll go through this. This will be, in a sense, a bit of a three-part talk, in a sense, where we go through the past experiences of our panelists and myself as well, the present-day situation of diversity and inclusion in physiotherapy. And then we'll look to the future and see what can we do, what are the possible solutions, what are realistic solutions, and how can we get to a future where we want to get to, which I'm sure everyone here has similar goals, maybe slightly different approaches, but at the end of the day, we all have similar interests to the betterment of physiotherapy and getting to physiotherapy to a point where we're all happy with it and we can look around and we see different people, different colors in all shapes and sizes in all different areas. So now let's each of our panelists give a brief introduction and a brief remark as to why they chose to come on this talk and why it's important to them, and also a brief introduction from everyone. So I think I'll start with you, Andrew, just because you are, I think you might, to my left.
Okay, so I'm Andrew Jaggi. I'm a physiotherapist and I've been working in the National Health Service probably now for about 26 years. So I'm a bit embarrassed to say it's that long, but yeah, I'm getting on a bit. I'm based at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital, so my area of interest is orthopaedics and shoulders. I came on this panel today because, you know, I'm really concerned about particularly the lack of BME in senior positions. I'm a big advocate for trying to get more women and BME into senior roles in the NHS and in physiotherapy. But, you know, the bottom line is I think my real concern is that we're not representative of a population. And at the end of the day, we know that we can treat our patients far better if we represent them well. And so I think the honest truth here is we've got to start making that happen a bit more, because we're not, as a profession, representing, I don't think, our population truly.
Great. I think we have that's very wonderful words, Andrew. Thank you very much. I think we have Ishmael next up, if you don't mind.
Hi, my name is Ishmael Beckford. I'm a director at a large independent organisation which provides mental and physical health services. I recently also appointed to a role as CSP council member, which was co-opted from the Black, Asian and Minority Ethnic Network. Really, I'm sort of, you know, excited to be here just to discuss what is a really important topic alongside a great panel. It's something that's always been an important topic, but it's one where it feels like there is almost a window now to try and accelerate progress. So, you know, it's great that we can use this platform to share our experiences and thoughts, you know, hopefully move the conversation forwards and engage more people in the discussion.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Ishmael. And Uzo, you might go next. Just a brief introduction.
Hi, my name's Uzo Ehiok. I'm also a physiotherapist. So I work at the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital and also in private practice. My special area is rehabilitation, and I'm a little bit vocal about that. So I'm on this really fundamentally, I guess, because probably similar to what everyone else has said so far, but, you know, I'm almost thinking about the future, really. You know, we need to ensure that we have a pipeline of talent, you know, from all sectors of the community. And hopefully this is just one way to ensure that that happens.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Uzo, for coming on. And Manny, you can go up next.
My name is Emmanuel Vola. I'm a physiotherapist currently working in the private sector. I am a specialist running physiotherapist, and I managed to do some coaching. And I'm the founder of the Cultural Health Club, which is a community interest company We are looking to change the narrative around how physiotherapists from minority communities basically experience the workplace and physiotherapy as a profession. Along with that, we would like to start to use that kind of elevated knowledge within the workforce to provide health promotion and disease prevention within minority communities. This is a new venture and it started this year because we feel minority communities need this, minority physios need this. And I'm really passionate about providing support to physiotherapists now and physiotherapists of the future from minority groups, and keeping the conversation going about the state of our profession and how we may enhance and improve it. So that's a lot of words, but that's me.
great, thanks a lot. And Leanne, if you don't mind.
Hi everyone, my name's Leanne Antoine. I am the clinical lead and director of Distinct Physiotherapy. I am here for a few different reasons. The first thing is that when George Floyd was murdered, I reached out to Jack Chu, to say to him that, look, there are some issues in terms of racism within physiotherapy. And the issues for me had been sitting there for a long time, but they never felt like there was the right time to talk about it. And I also run my own business, and there would, I know, be risks or implications in terms of being excessively vocal about these things. And there hasn't been a time to talk about these things as it is now. That's just the truth. The reason why I spoke to Jack in particular was because I attended a physiotherapy event where I was perceived to be one of the catering staff. And it was a situation that, because I think there are a lot of things that happen to us in our lives and you don't address them, they don't actually go away. They just come up in a different way, almost like they're trying to say to you, what are you going to do with that now? You ignored me once, you ignored me twice, you ignored me three times. I'm not going to let you ignore me this time round. And I think that George Floyd's death really brought a lot of that emotion, trauma, lived experience to a surface for me as a Black female physiotherapist who has felt for a long time there's not been enough support for people that look like me. There's not enough doors that are open for people that look like me. And whilst I am in like complete favor of BAME, I speak as a Black woman. I don't speak as BAME. I speak as a Black woman and my own experiences. And I own that, right? The conversation I had with Jack is white and I am Black. Jack cannot say to me that he completely understands where I'm coming from. But Jack, for me, did one of those things that I think so many physiotherapists are currently trying to do, and that was he listened and he affirmed, you know? And I think when I listen to Jack, he is definitely a thought leader within our profession, regardless of his years within physiotherapy. There was something about that space that then made me say, okay, do you know what? If I can talk to one person about it who is willing to affirm, there are others who are also and will be willing to do the same. And I don't think it's necessarily just about having allies to support this as a movement. And I'm not talking about BLM. I'm talking about diversity, inclusion, and inclusion as a whole. And if I can be a small part, if I can play a small part in that, I feel like my work on this planet is done. I feel like the purpose behind this as a topic, I'm so passionate about it, that if I can change one or two views about this and it helps my godchildren, my nieces and nephews, you know, people that look like me, and it helps them to move in the future, then I feel like my work is done. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you for the powerful words, Leanne. I think those words are very powerful and they resonate with a lot of people, yes, myself especially. And I just realized I didn't even introduce myself. My name is Farouk Bello. I'm a physiotherapist as well. I'm probably the least experienced physiotherapist here because I'm just starting. But I run a Rooks Health podcast, which is my podcast on the side. But I think for me, as what piggybacking off what Leanne said, one of the reasons that I also decided to do this was because I realized that I'm young in my career and I'm young, but I can imagine, I've heard from people who are a lot older than me, is that when you talk about change and you talk about diversity and inclusion, we tend to often say change takes time and change takes a lot of time. And they'll tell my dad that, and they'll tell me that, and they'll tell my children that, and they'll keep telling everyone that change takes a lot of time. But how much time, the real question is, how much time is change going to take? Now, piggybacking off of that, now, before we start this and move into the more meaty portions of this debate, I think it's important we define what we are, what we mean by diversity and inclusion, so that we don't get that misinterpreted or we don't get our words misinterpreted. So I'll start with you, Manny. If you could give us a definition of what you think diversity and inclusion actually means.
So I think from my context of where I feel the profession needs to change is the diversity of individuals at levels within the profession where we can have an influence on the profession. So the diversity and the changes in the makeup of professionals in hierarchical positions is really important, because that breeds inclusion, because we know then you can have a voice to change the narrative within the profession. So those two things for me are where I am kind of pushing, and the definition for me in this context, in this conversation, is actually, yeah, changing the way the profession looks at hierarchical level, and changing what that means for people being included in conversations, that, you know, the conversations, you have to come to the conversation and be at the table and be heard. We know that's a big part of inclusion, you know, it's being heard. And sometimes when you're in an authoritative position, you can be heard. So those are my takes on diversity and inclusion.
Does anyone want to add anything to that? Andrew, do you like to add something to that, your definition of diversity and inclusion? Or is it a line?
I think the important thing for me, that diversity means bringing a wide range of people who've all got something to bring to a table. You know, what we're lacking at the moment by not having diversity, and it's something I touched upon earlier with you, so, is we're not tapping into all the talent that's out there. You know, that's the honest truth here. You know, there is lots of untapped talent in women, in blacks, in Asians, in whites. And if we stop looking at the colour and the gender, and we look at the skill set and the knowledge and the talent, this country would be dealing with COVID way better. I can tell you now, it'll be dealing with our economy far better. What I'm saying is there is talent, and let's start looking at that and not the colour of somebody or the gender of somebody. For me, diversity is about bringing skill sets and getting the best out of people, getting the best boards. That to me is what diversity means, and including everyone. Creativity. No, you bring creativity to a table when you've got a diverse group.
Brilliant.
I think sometimes having people within hierarchical positions sometimes that are different to the status quo takes courage for some organizations to do that. And the problem is that, you know, you've talked about skill set, you've talked about creativity, and it's like, how does somebody recognize a skill set they haven't seen before? So like, I completely agree with you, but there's also an element where there's this huge hurdle where it's like,
yeah,
oh, well, yeah, we want this to be diverse. It's like, okay, we've got a quota. We haven't met our quota. So what do we do? It's like, there's all these things. And I feel like there needs to be, and we'll get onto it later on in the talk, but there needs to be strategic moves to actually create diversity. But diversity is one part of it. Diversity is a small section. Inclusion for me is the key part, because inclusion is like, I am here at the table and my voice and what I'm telling you is being used and implemented within the structure and the systems and the services, because that will definitely filter down, because people will be like, well, okay, this person from my community has influenced this service. The service may be in a specific way, which that may make me feel actually I would like to utilize that service because it's in a specific, it's designed in a specific way, and we can get onto broader details about that later.
Can I say, Farouk, I think that if there is enough diversity, there will inherently be enough inclusion. That if because the issue, the big issue that we have is that if I don't see people like me at the top, how do I know I can achieve that? Nobody looks like they paved the way for me. So I don't actually know if I can be there. I might think I can, but I haven't seen anybody else get there. So I don't know that I can, right? And that means I don't have anybody to ask. That means I don't have a path to follow. And if I follow who's already there, are they going to guide me in the way that they were guided? Are they going to be aware of the potential obstacles and challenges that I might face on the way? They're not aware of them because they haven't lived it in the same way I have. They haven't experienced it and won't. The one thing that's individual about us all is that we will experience everything individually. But if I have a few things that are in common with you, I can collectively come together and at least see one or two things that might be a limitation, an advantage, a disadvantage. More diversity will equal the inclusion. It will naturally come.
I think we're all right. They go hand in hand together, and it's the approaches that we take that makes a significant difference. And I'm sure we'll get into a lot more detail as we go along in this wonderful chat we have now. But I have a question for you, Uzo. This is a point where we'll start with the past of physiotherapy. Now the question is, when you were studying physiotherapy, and if you could tell the audience and listenership, how long ago was that when you were studying? How did your classroom look?
Ooh, interesting. Interesting. So firstly, I have to tell you how many years I've been qualified for, which I'm not embarrassed about, actually, quite proud of, actually. So it's 16 years, and I went to the University of East London. Absolutely. So what I can say, actually, about the University of East London was, so there was 90 people in our cohort, and from that 90 people, we had about, I would say about 10 were either Black or Asian, I would say, about 10. Now, bearing in mind, 16 years ago, that was a lot, okay? That was an awful lot. Now, in fairness to the University of East London, I think they were trailblazers, and I think what they did at that time was they probably upset a lot of the physiotherapy profession, I suspect. Certainly within the locality, I believe, because they took risks. So they started up a part-time program, which was a situated learning program, where you could work in the NHS for a couple of days a week, and also you could go to university. So that was groundbreaking. But getting back to your point, so what I'm saying actually is the University of East London, I was quite lucky really, because there was quite a few of us back then. But fundamentally, I mean, most obviously out of the 90, 80 were white. But there was quite a few mature students as well. Do you want to ask me another question
the reason I'm asking this question, it'll become apparent in a second now. And the reason I won't ask this question is because one of the things we see is, in my year, we were only about four black students, and then we had a handful. Is that diminishing number of how many of us are actually getting on the course? And I'll ask you this question, Ishmael. I'll ask you pretty much the same question, Ishmael. How many are you? And I'll ask Andrew as well, just so we can see that comparison. And obviously, this is not a scientific analysis of anything, because we are a small sample size as well. But just give our experiences, but that's why we're here at the end of the day, is to share our experiences and see how much things have changed in the past to where they are now in the present and where we would like them to go in the future. So Ishmael.
Yeah, so I started uni in 2003, I think it was, and I started the course, and there was one other black student, and there was a student of a dual heritage background, and I believe one or two other Asian students. And I think during my time in uni, I don't think I met a single other student who was from a black Caribbean background like myself. So I found it, you know, very, very isolating as a student. There wasn't, you know, didn't see people who were like me. Interestingly, at the uni I was at, there was quite a sort of strong African society that was there, but actually being from a Caribbean background, I didn't quite fit in there either. So there was, now I found there was lots of challenges about with the lack of sort of representation, not seeing people like myself, not only on the course as fellow students, but the teaching staff, there wasn't anybody with sort of visible diversity, going on to placement, even worse, you know, environments where, again, there just wasn't anybody that you could automatically identify with who would have similar experiences to you. And that's all sort of you know, compounded by what's generally a challenging, stressful, you know, time being a student. You know, going, a lot of people going away from home for the first time, long stints away from family who provide you with that, you know, stability in normal circumstances. So for me, you know, it's really disappointing and upsetting to hear that actually it's not, doesn't really sound like it's changed an awful lot over sort of 10-15 years, and the representation still isn't there. You know, physios from a black Asian minority background are still having the same experiences, still being isolated, still not necessarily being supported. So I think the lack of representation is one thing, but then also then not supporting people you know, when once they're in that environment, once it's kind of obvious that actually they're going to have different needs and different support requirements is another thing which really sort of doubles down on some of the issues that we've highlighted.
Yeah, and I think before I get, I'll give my own two cents on the matter, but I'll ask Andrew, why do you think, piggyback off what he's saying, because I know we were having a chat before we started the live, why is this an important thing? Why is this an important issue that we're even mentioning about talking about how it was back then? And if you could give us your own brief synopsis of when you were studying as well, and then I'll give mine.
So I don't know if I'm the oldest in the group, but I was 10 years before Uzo. I started physio in 1988. So we're talking 30 odd years ago. I also went to the University of East London. And I agree with Uzo. For me, that was a university that was forward thinking. It took mature students. We had some gay students. So I was one of two Asians. And if I recall, there was one black physio. So it was three of us. So that's just telling you that was 30 years ago. And to listen to someone like Ishmael, to listen to someone like Uzo and tell me that those figures fundamentally haven't hugely changed, I cannot tell you how upsetting that makes me feel. And I can joke about it now, because, you know, I'll share with you, Uzo will know this, but at the University of East London, at that time, we were part of the London Hospital. So we were based in Mile End or Whitechapel, and we were still very much connected to the hospital and to the medical college, and so to the students there. And for my whole time, I did physio. Everyone thought whenever I walked into the student union that I was either a medic or a dentist, because that's what Asians do, right? Asians don't do physio. And I also want to share with you that when I decided to do physio as a profession, that my parents turned around to me and just couldn't understand why. Why was I not doing medicine? Why didn't I get a decent job? I'm pleased to say that actually through my own career and through what I've achieved, I've actually encouraged a lot of Asian kids to do physio. And I'm really pleased to say that my parents now proudly go out, say I'm a physio, but also encourage their kids who are thinking, you know, their friends who've got kids to think about it as a profession. So I think I'm going to echo everything that's said. You need role models. Leanne's right. You've got to have people who people can see that, okay, I can get there. The tragedy, though, is that what we're now not seeing is that profession going into senior roles. I'm very unique, guys. You know, there's not many physios that get to consultant level, but
I agree.
The problem is we started with a low number. Yeah. So, you know, for Lou and Leanne saying when you want people who are higher up, where are they going to come from when we can't even get them through the door? That's why this is important.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right on the head there where I was trying to go with this conversation, because if you look to myself now, I just finished graduating. In my year, we were about, I think, 4 Black students and a handful of Asian students. I've seen across in different universities where you probably won't even see a Black student at all. And for me, as a young, it is very interesting in my head because all going through placements, going through multiple placements, I didn't really see as many people. And the significance, I think for me personally, the significance of that, seeing people who look like me and in different higher positions of power and things like this, it brings into the next thing, which I think we talked about, was like mentorship and being able to pave the way, as Manny was saying, is that, no, if no one is there, you don't see anyone together, you don't really believe at some point that you can actually get there. You don't, may not start thinking that maybe this isn't for you. You might not feel welcome in that sense. Now, so to pose the next question is, as piggyback off of what Andrew said, going to you, Leanne, these challenges that we face, these challenges and these issues, why do you think that they are there? Why do you think that this is the way it is? Is this the new normal? Is this how it's just supposed to be, where 30 years ago you had 2 people in a year and 30 years later you still have only 2, or you still have very, very, very low numbers?
I will say to you that this is like this because people like me didn't speak up quick enough. If you think about when I was qualifying or when I was recognizing that this was an issue, I also wasn't in a position that if I did speak up that anyone would really listen. So it was like my voice didn't really matter. And when I was applying to do my physiotherapy degree, because I did mine like Uzo, I did a part-time physio degree. The hospital I worked for constantly said no before letting me go onto the course. Okay. There will be physios that watch this back that I will have worked with who will be very aware of the number of times I had to knock on the door to get the opportunity to do physiotherapy part-time. And I recall being 19 years old at the bottom of the NHS food chain as a physiotherapy assistant, and my mum saying to me, do not come back home and tell me that you haven't gone and asked those people again to do that course, right?
Yeah.
I'm saying at the bottom of the food chain at 19, I would go in early to work to knock on the door of the physiotherapy manager. Okay, 19. To say, hi, I'm Leanne. Do you remember me? Of course she remembered me. I was on her door last week, because if I went home to that strong Black woman as a mother and told her again that I hadn't gone and asked for my opportunity, what do you think my life would have looked like? Right? And I think that this looks the way that it does now, because even for me as a strong, resilient character, I know what my one fight has been. Now, to carry that for others on your own, because until this, there has been no real collective. I was there at the BAME network 5 and 6 years ago, and there were only 12 of us. There's 58,000 chartered physios. I was there. Yeah. The reason why we are like this is through fear. Who do we say? Who do we tell? And then when we speak, what do we want to be done about it? What does that actually look like? Is this actually a priority? I know that I've had conversations within the CSP, and people have said, you know, Leanne, you just need to be patient. The same way you talk about grandfather, are they going to tell your dad? And these will be the same people that will say to me, I'm doing the work. I'm getting coaching. I'm doing the work. And I will say to anybody who's watching this, if you talk to a person of colour and talk about patience, it's really rude, because we've been waiting for so long for the opportunity to talk now very openly about some of the things that we have experienced. I had a coach today message me in my inbox on LinkedIn and said to wanted to discuss with me about traumas that I might have been through. And I asked her, were they traumas or would we be discussing lived experiences? Because some of these experiences are just repeated. And this is why this hasn't changed over 30 years. Because what was, you know, the some of the difficulties that Andrew would have faced and wasn't able to voice, 20 odd years later, I'm facing them and I can't voice them. Uzo is facing them and he can't voice them, because we're always a minority. So even if we come together, it still doesn't sound, it's not collective enough and it's not strong enough. And that's why with people like Manny, for example, putting something together like cultural health or the ACPT network. And I said this today, as one voice, I can shout, I can scream, I can be loud. Collectively, we can be heard, because that diversity is bringing the ability, the capacity for some inclusion. That's why we're here. Fear, not enough of us coming together. And the third thing is the fact that the people at the top haven't prioritized this. They haven't made this. The physiotherapy, when I was applying for it, was highly competitive. The grades that we needed to get in were not necessarily the grades that we needed to do the job, but they could put the grades up because the volume.
Yeah.
The necessity for that volume, did it in some way leave out the ability for BAME to apply? Did it? That's why
we... It's a very interesting point. And I think that will follow nicely with Uzo's point. But I want to get to Manny while we're on the topic of this. Is that one of the reasons, Manny, why you felt like the CHC was Cultural Health Club was an important thing to develop? Does that tie in with one of the values of Cultural Health Club, as what Leanne piggyback off what Leanne said?
First of all, I'd like to say, like, from my perspective, I think I always think Leanne, as you're saying, when you were coming up and Andrew was coming up and Uzo were coming up and Ishmael, there's an element of survival. So like David Williams, he's really like, there's an element of like, yeah, you're getting through it because this is, you know, you're getting through the hurdles of day-to-day life and you actually can't think of, okay, let me open the door for somebody else. But I think there's an element where, you know, I wouldn't say, I'd say things have moved on because I'm now able to get to a point where I'm like, Cultural Health Club is something I know I can do. And I guess there's an element where this something must have changed for me to be able to get to this point, to have Cultural Health Club and have a group and ACPT be a group as well. And I think from my perspective, I think that there's a lot of elements that have created the issues that we're in at the moment. And one of them will be is that for me, within the CSP, having people that are knowledgeable enough to actually tackle the issues, that are knowledgeable enough to understand the experiences, and having Ishmael being there at council meetings is a big step forward. And I think we have to keep pushing, and yeah. Like there are always going to be ways that we have to evolve and be innovative in the way we think. And I think things will change, but there are hurdles, constant hurdles. Yeah. And I think the difference is there are now these new pockets. There are now these innovative ways of doing things. We have ways we can speak to people on social media. We have this round table. We have so much that we can do. And you know, having all of us here in this conversation, could we have done this 10 years ago? So
that raises the question. And talking on the
can I just say, It's really interesting listening to the words that Manny uses. Manny, if you want to shout me out about this later, but I was listening to We Have to Keep Pushing. Yeah. And there are hurdles. There are going to be hurdles, challenges. And naturally, if I'm pushing something, that means that there's something pushing me back.
There's resistance,
yeah? If I'm having to jump a hurdle, I'm having to climb and get over something to get to the other side, right? And actually, a massive part of me feels like this is not about a push. It's not about a hurdle. It's not about the challenges. It's about the ability to say to people, you know, it's about, yeah, the ability to say, this is the truth. This is what has definitely been happening. And we know that it's not just happened to me or you. And then it's about saying, can you walk this journey with me to change, to make change? When we as physiotherapists are trying to get our patients to understand their journeys, Uzo says he loves rehab and he shouts about that. Uzo doesn't focus then on the thing that the person can't do. He focuses on how he can help them to do the thing that they're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
He doesn't keep pushing back at the thing that's pushing at them. He shows them a different route. And that route opens a door to that person being able to achieve something. And it may be that he says one thing or he does one thing that makes that person, that patient, go, ping, get it. I get it. And I feel like with the CSP, and certain other, bodies within physiotherapy, it's that button, it's that light bulb, it's that switch. The knowledge, the education, the skill, the time I've spent, the time you've spent, Manny, Uzo, talking to people, to other physiotherapists, and giving lots of our time and lots of our energy and it all being very emotional. I'm doing that because I want people to feel me.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to keep saying to them that this is my constant struggle. When you can feel what I'm saying to you, you will want to walk with me to make change. And it won't look like it has to be a new normal. It will just be normal. It will be okay for it to be that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. And as we have Ishmael here, who's with the CSP, I think I want to ask you the question, do you feel like you being part of this, or was this a new thing? Can you tell us about your role within the CSP? And do you feel like having you being there actually helps the cause, as Leanne was saying, actually paves this new way of thinking, of this new way of what should be the new normal, in a sense, if that question was clear enough?
Yeah, look, it's really, really new. So I'm about 2 weeks in. I've only had sort of one formal council meeting and still sort of partway through the whole induction process. It's definitely a positive and a step in the right direction. It enables there to be a more diverse voice at council meetings. The nature of the role, because of how it was established, means that although that voice is there, there's not a voting influence. So I can contribute to the conversation. I can try to share, my own personal experiences and the experience of others that I'm aware of. I can try and ensure that conversations are had with minority physios in mind, and in doing so, yes, I think there's a degree of influence there, but I think that the goal has to be getting to a point where there's a council member with full voting rights and ideally multiple council members from diverse backgrounds on the council to make sure that it is representative. I think I think Leanne's points are really pertinent, and something that I've kind of come to the conclusion about is that it a lot of this comes down to people need to care, and there's a number of reasons why people will care about things, whether it's because it has a direct impact on them, because it has they see what the overall benefits are, and there's lots of evidence now around kind of the benefits of diversity, you know, within organizations, whether that be around, you know, driving innovation or high levels of satisfaction, lower degree of conflict, even within organizations, you know, high degrees of sales or profits, you know, if you're talking about sort of private or commercial enterprises. So there's lots of benefits, which I think people are starting to understand, actually, there is something in this for me. And that's almost, unfortunately, a selfish point at which the change needs to come. But sometimes that's what you do need. And sometimes it's actually about twisting, it's people's arms being twisted, it's people being called out, it's people being, you know, people who say they're one thing, being you asking them to demonstrate that they're the thing that they said they are, because often, you know, people's words are not sort of mirrored by their actions. And I think that's sometimes something which has been a big frustration for members of the, you know, members of the group, people saying that we're for these issues, but not actually acting, you know, in an appropriate manner, whether that be acting at all or acting in a timely fashion. So I think that, you know, coming back to the council role, it's an important role. It is a step forward. I'd like to think that, yes, at some point in the future, you know, that will become the new normal, and there will be broad, diverse representation on the CSP council. And this isn't just about the CSP council. You know, this is we're talking about throughout the profession as a whole, in through all levels of the profession, and yes, you know, senior positions, board level positions, executive positions is you know, particularly of interest to me, seeing people get to that point. And I think, yeah, you know, if me getting close to that and delivering those sort of roles helps people to see that it can be done, great. But I'm sort of very adamant that I'm not sort of here to pat myself on the back, and I don't think the work's done. We're miles off where we need to be, and that's kind of the realistic that's a realistic truth. So I think, yes, we've sort of taken steps forwards, and you know, interesting. I've had recent conversations about, you know, do you think things are better? And I think particularly when we're talking about, you know, the experience that, you know, maybe Andrew had and Uzo had, and back to you sort of Farouk, over that time frame, have things improved? You know, it's often actually a conversation that I think is a bit pointless, because and that's not being disrespectful to the people that have put the work in and helped me get to where I am. It's about saying we've not arrived at the destination that we're aiming for. So yes, acknowledge what's changed and acknowledge the things that are different. We're not where we need to be yet. And that, I think that's a really important thing. Even though this, you know, having this forum and this group for me would be unheard of, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. You know, I remember when I got worked in private practice, and Uzo might not even remember this, but I think it was when I think maybe you worked at London Bridge. I think it was.
London Bridge.
I've been working in private practice, and Uzo was the first person I'd seen in private, black man I'd seen in private practice, independent sector, for 4 years. You know, that's ridiculous.
As a manager,
as a manager. So for me, you know, yes, there have, you know, there are people that have had successes, but we're not where we need to be. And I think it's really important that we keep up the momentum with what we're doing. And even if there are, you know, I suppose small successes or things that look like we're taking steps in the right direction, that we don't sort of slow up. We keep pushing. Yeah. And as Manny said, we keep pushing those hurdles over, we keep pushing past those barriers, because as I said, there's a lot still to be done.
I think also it's important for us to now on this call explain some of the things that we're talking about. I guess we know only one person from, well, I think it's Mauro Stewart, who's the only person who's been on CSP Council from a minority group. Is that right?
Yeah.
So if we're talking about what, you know, if people are wondering what we're talking about, this is what we're talking about. CSP Council has been going on for, you know, however many years, and Mauro Stewart is the only person. Now we have two people here who are consultant physiotherapists for minority groups. Do we know these are the only two people in the UK, or do we have more? Because I, you know, looking through Twitter and networking and talking to people, to be honest, I haven't found any others. I found lots in research, but I probably could be sitting with the only two consultant physiotherapists from an ethnic minority group, by the way, just to give you an insight into what's going on.
But Manny, I think actually I'm listening to this and I'm sort of pondering and philosophizing, and I think actually it's quite circular in a way, because, and the reason why it's circular is because, so I've been on national committees. So I was a communications officer for the MACP for about 6 years, okay, which was a huge time burden. It was a huge time burden, but I did it anyway because I was passionate about physiotherapy, rehabilitation, and also I knew that it would probably help my career in some way. But it was a huge, huge burden, okay, for 6 years. Now, but I was in a position where actually I was able to do that because at the time I was a manager in a private hospital. Then I moved to the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital and then became a teaching fellow. So I was in a position where actually I was able to as a part of job plan, work plan, and also I'd reached a point in my career where I had additional time, maybe in the evenings, you know, kids were a bit older, so on and so forth. And I suspect getting on those committees, it needs people who have that time capacity, have the ability to manage their own diaries, dare I say. And actually, if you don't have people of colour who have got to that level, then they can't access those particular committees, because those committees, if you're a band six, for example, or you're a band five physiotherapist and you apply to go onto one of those committees, yeah, great. But is your boss, okay, gonna allow you to have the time during your working week to go and do this committee work? Probably not. So you're going to end up having to do it in your own time all the time. If you're a single parent and also you're doing that, well, good luck. It's just not going to happen with the best will in the world. Of course, it may do. You know, maybe I'm stereotyping somewhat, but I think it's circular in that it's these national committees, they take up time. And yeah. I don't know what you think, Angie.
I think you're right. I think, look, the bottom line is, I hate to say this, but, you know, to go up the ladder, you kind of got to put the effort and the work in. You know, that happens for lots of people. But the conversation we were having before this went live was, you don't know what you need to know. So one of the disadvantages is if you don't have a culture that you've come from where you've had that networking mentality, you've had parents who know how to play the game, dare I say it, how to write your CV up robustly, how to give you mentorship. You come already from a privileged background, like we were saying, you know, you've got parents around, you've got all the infrastructure around you, you've got cousins, uncles, aunts who've been into university. You know, you absorb all of this as you're going along. And Uzo's right, is that, you know, I was really, when he told me about the stats, and Uzo, you probably have to probably say this, but when you look at the number of students who are applying, Black students applying to physio university, and then the ones who actually get accepted, this is more complicated. This is about unconscious biases to one degree that are sitting on selection panels. And we know that's a little bit of a problem because, you know, how are you going to get a mixed diverse group when you don't have enough senior people? Yeah. So one thing is unconscious bias. But the second thing is also the applicant's ability to be mentored appropriately, to know how to work the system. Now, you know, you should get to a point where you shouldn't need to do that. You shouldn't need to fit the mold. You shouldn't need to be like, but the bottom line is that's where we're still at the moment. We're a very class-based society. And one other thing I was going to say as I was listening to everybody, you don't have to always have a Black mentor or an Asian mentor. I can tell you from now, I didn't have those people. But what I did have is I had great white mentors, male mentors. In fact, the surgeon and Uzo will know this, that Ian Bailey is one of the great mentors I had. You just have to have somebody who believes in you as an individual and believes in you in your talent. Okay, that's what this is about. And that's what we've got to try and get across, that when you're interviewing people, see beyond that. So I think, but I do agree. I think some of the disadvantages that play against is, you know, if you don't have the time, you're busy, you're part-time, you're trying to balance lots of things, it is incredibly hard. But I have also seen people who've achieved it because they are so determined to get to where they need to. But selection is unconscious biases, the lack of mentorship. You know, we need to be starting at school level, guys. This isn't, yep. I'd almost say it's almost too late at physio school. We've got to start at the school. We've got to start with
the very young.
I slightly disagree. I think that we need to invest in people who are in the profession now. And we can give them resources right now, and we can.
Yeah, we need to do all
right
of
now.
It.
Definitely, yeah, because I believe that you go to school level, you're going to have people in 10 years or 6 years or whatever, 7 years. But you've got people right now who you can say, OK, let's get you into the NHS. Let's get you doing something in the NHS. Let's get you into the private sector. But also what I would like to say is that there's an element of, you've all seen that picture of the boxes. So you get
equity, equality,
exactly. So everybody is different. We have to treat people and provide them with additional support. You know, if you have a child and you have childcare issues, your boss is not saying to you, well, yeah, you need to come into work. So if you're from a certain background and you have particular challenges that mean that your attendance at university may be influenced, or you know your ability to go to a placement where you need to be in the community with a car. No one's going to put you in a placement with a community with a car, are they? Oh. So I think there's elements of this where actually I'm quite frustrated, because if somebody's at university and they're doing all they can, but they need additional support, give them additional support, because you can get the best out of those. Get them to be as comfortable as possible. Give them as many resources as possible. And if they can't do the course, fair enough. But there is an element where we have to provide additional resources. There's a really good YouTube video of a doctor, and she talks about different flowers need different types, different amounts of water. It's the same with human beings. So everybody needs slightly more, slightly less. You might have, as we say, two-parent family household. You may have somebody within your household or within your family, within your inner, you know, your parents' friendship circles who are a physio. So they can give you that work experience in a hospital. So when you're doing your application, you get an interview straight away. Whereas we're talking in Cultural Health Club, most people, they didn't know how to get experience in a hospital for their job applications. No, like... And it's like, well, what are these hospitals?
This is the key bit about,
so I think we're saying the same thing, Manu. You know, we're saying the same thing. I totally agree with you. That's what I've said, that not everyone's coming in with the same footing. So I think we're saying the same thing. Mm. Udo, sorry.
Because I think everyone's getting it. I think one of the morals of the story is that there are multiple battles to be fronted, different fronts, in a sense, if you understand what I mean, is that there is the, as Manny has said, is the emphasis on the elder, on the people who are there now already. And there's also looking back to say, if you want a continuous stream, you have to also look at the back end of things. Like, I think Uzo has some statistics and he had a slide for us prepared. Unfortunately, we won't be able to show it, but it's focusing on these two fronts. And I know it sounds almost, contradictory saying focusing on two fronts, but it's the options we have, in a sense that, you know, there are people there now who need to get into these positions. And there are also people who are just about to come up. As we said, if you're going back to, as Andrew brought with the statistics, looking at A-levels and saying people are not getting on. And if there are a few numbers getting on, these numbers just keep on getting smaller and smaller. And by the time you get to the top, it's almost non-existent. But I think, Uzo, I think you were about to say something with regards to, you have some statistics.
Yeah, no, I guess I was just going to, I found some statistics. These are publicly available, by the way. 2017 to 2018, so the student profile. So the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy, they produce an annual quality review on UK pre-registration physiotherapy education. And what's really, really interesting is when you look at the stats, clearly, there are more white students than there are BAME students. Well, that kind of makes sense, because if you think about the population, the UK population, 80% of the population is white. So that's not unreasonable by any stretch of the imagination. But what was really, really interesting, and this is something which slightly concerns me, is so how many BAME students apply to UCAS? Okay, and again, this is stats from the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy. So if we look at the stats, basically, in the year 2015 to 2017, in essence, so 74%, out of 100%, so 74.5% of white students applied via UCAS. Okay, of that, so, and then 21.5% were from a BAME background applied. Yeah, so 74.5% versus 21.5%. Now, as I said, you know, the vast majority of the population in the UK are white, so it makes perfect sense that actually, you know, more people from a white background would apply to be physiotherapists. That doesn't sound unreasonable by any stretch of the imagination. However, how many people, when you look at how many people actually get on the course, yeah, who actually get on the course. So of the 74.5%, okay, of white students, okay, 88% of that 74.5%, okay, from the white student group were accepted. 88%. But now, if you look at the BAME students, okay, so from that 22% that actually applied, okay, via UCAS, only 12% were accepted. 12%. So just over 50% compared to the three quarters. So it then leads me on to ask the question, really. And the question is this. It probably leaves more questions than answers. Okay. Yeah. Why is it that just over 50% of potential students are actually getting places? Now, I don't actually know. And there isn't, and there probably isn't any evidence there currently. But, you know, there is some evidence to suggest that BAME students feel marginalized on courses. So we've got several studies over the last sort of 5 or 6 years where normally there's studies where they look at the lived experience of, you know, students from Black, Asian and also minority backgrounds, you know, various different studies. And they're kind of saying the same thing, really. It's they don't get us. We're having to change how we are to fit in, which actually smacks of a lack of inclusion from my perspective. So, you know, just looking at those numbers, and again, I don't have answers, but the numbers, unfortunately, don't lie, and they are from the CSP. And what's really interesting from my perspective is these numbers have been within the public domain for some time, but yet I don't really see a concerted effort by the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy to really understand this, because this was, what, almost 3 years ago, but yet still, okay, I don't see a report on why there is this disparity. In fact, I mean, I've seen nothing. Now, maybe they have done some work, but I haven't seen it yet.
So I'm gonna ask the question now, piggybacking off what you just said now. Two questions, actually. Is that suggestive, which may be, is that suggestive of discrimination? And if so, what kind of discrimination is that suggestive of?
Can I just say, just in relation to that, Barry, is that this comes right back to when I said, when people are applying, the numbers are already so high. Why would you report on this? There's no issue. We've got the numbers. Do you see what I'm saying? I've got 100 seats and I need 100 seats filled. Just fill the 100. I haven't told you what they need to look like. I've put the grades at this. So, and I can, if I've got 1,000 people and I've got 100 seats and it means I can take the ones who get all the A grades, I'm going to take the ones that get all the A grades. That's essentially what's happening. You know, whether there is then the division, you know, the in terms of percentage, as you're saying, then if you've got you know, three quarters more white people in comparison to the black people, then you would be saying, actually, then those numbers are relative. When you then look at what that intake is, what we're saying is, I think, that the numbers going into, and I said this, I will say this very openly, I said this to Karen Middleton, our CEO of the Charter Society of Physiotherapy, that we needed to look at that. We know that the numbers are high for people wanting to be physiotherapists, whether it's been driven by sport or not, that's irrelevant. If we want some diversity and some inclusion, we need to start looking at exactly who it is that we're taking on the course. And it then brings me right back full circle to what Andrew says. We are potentially missing some gems of people because we're not looking now at your personality, your characteristics, your enthusiasm, your passion for the body, your ability to connect with people. I'm only looking at your grades. Looking at my grades, does that mean where I went to school? Was that private or not? What does that mean? Who was in my network? How strong is that? Right? Your network is as strong as your net worth. So what is it then that we're trying to say about what we want for physiotherapy? And that being representative to the patients that we treat. When my patients come to see me, they come to see me because they know that I'm good at what I do. And we want that over tokenism, 120%. When people go to see Andrew, she is at the top of her game. When they go to see her and they have a shoulder problem, is the first analysis that she's Indian? Or actually, am I just seeing the best person? She's
the best. Papers, seen the best.
Collabed with Simon Lambert. Like, that's what we want. And that's the reason why I've gone off and worked privately. I knew I was good at this. And I knew I was passionate enough about my patients to be able to carry it on my back by myself. Because if I was waiting for the people to give me the confidence and the support that I thought I needed and deserved whilst I was working, I wasn't going to get it in its entirety. That doesn't mean to say that I didn't have fantastic mentors. Pat Canning at Barnett, Barvis Mistry of Healthstream Physiotherapy, Indian. Pat Canning was white. I had some really influential people who were not black. Yeah. Who saw that potential and nurtured it for me.
Agree.
The reason why Amen. We have to have somebody like Manny doing cultural health for our physios now who are already working is because we haven't done the work in the schools. And essentially, if that work has been done in the schools and is started now, it doesn't need to be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we are qualified, we are already, the playing field is already level. We have to do it now because that support has not been there.
But is it not what the CSP should be doing? This is my argument. This is my argument. It's like this is
everybody.
This is what I will say. You know, and I'm sure, I don't know, people from the CSP might drop me an inbox. I'm not sure. But when I have had conversations with people from the Charter Society of Physiotherapy, I think that we are giving them too much responsibility. We have raised that onto a pedestal. And the bottom line is this: the CSP have a job to a point. And even they are telling us that that job is to a point. Some of it has to be our own responsibility, and exactly what you were creating, exactly what the ACPT looks like, exactly what I have been developing as working on my own. These things have to be done. This is not one government. This is not one governing body's job. There's 58,000 chartered physiotherapists. How can we expect them to completely cater for all our needs on top of making sure that we are, for the public, safe to be there to treat, to do what we do? I understand, and I still feel like this has not been, as a topic, hasn't been a priority for a long time. Now, if you're asking me whether I think the CSP should be prioritizing it now, yes, 100%, 100%. But has it been possible to completely accommodate that when we haven't had the people at the top from a strategy and board level to be able to call this out and to be willing to call this out. Those people who are potential allies in this as a movement, not just for physiotherapy, but all over, some of them will be frightened about the repercussions for themselves. That's the truth.
I mean, maybe, Leanne, what you're saying is that, you know, this whole Black Lives Matter and the tragedy of the deaths that have occurred is it's got to be a societal change. This has got to be everybody's responsibility.
Everyone.
And you're talking about the student. I mean, it starts from the beginning, but we've even seen this within NHS organisations, the lack of Black and minorities moving up grading systems. So, you know, most of our BME are in the band fives and band sixes. So, but a lot of this, like we said, is about shifting culture and attitudes. You know, the simple things, showing Black kids mentors in books. You know, we've seen it on the news. Let's create characters because all they're seeing is a very one type of this is the way you look to be successful. This is the way, you know, even as a profession, do we see, you know, Asians see certain professions as those the professions they go into? I don't know how whether Black people do. I remember talking to some Black friends of mine and they said, Ange, nobody does physio. They all do law or media stuff or media stuff. So this is about us too, you know, guys. You know, that how much we feed our own stereotypical, you know, and I thought that. No, I'm not going to be a doctor. Yeah. I'm going to be a physio. I'm going to be bloody proud of it. It's everybody's responsibility, and I think it's unfair to kind of just, you know, it's all of us, and we have to create an environment. I totally agree with Leanne that everyone's got to come with an equal footing and be appreciative that some are going to be more advantaged and others not, like universities are doing now, you know, to start thinking, okay, these kids haven't had the same opportunities as some of their white middle class colleagues. And how do we ensure that when we're selecting them, we appreciate that? Maybe we shouldn't be asking three A's of them. Maybe we should be, you know, quite happy because actually the fact they've even got here is fantastic. It's like Leanne saying, it's looking beyond that. The problem we've got when I applied, yeah. To be honest with you, you could get into university pretty easily. I mean, I would never have got in now. You know, and we were interviewed and they saw us for our but you're right, Leanne, I think part of the problem now is that it's based on just numbers, isn't it? Numbers and grades. There isn't the ability to look at what other talent, and that was my question to all of you. I'm just interested to know how many of you were interviewed, and that was a discussion we were having before, to get into physio school. But then if you are interviewed, we've got to get unconscious biases out of the situation as well. Because he was on those panels.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the sort of key things that I want to flag, that I think a lot of the conversation is, you know, we're talking about the person element of this and the people who are in positions of influence, getting them to sort of almost change on a personal level and pick this up on a personal level. And the approach really needs to include changing the rigid element, so the structure, the processes, the procedures, the policies, it's that stuff that means that the biases that people have, which are actually really difficult to change. You know, it's really difficult to change behavior and get that to stick. And even, you know, even just as physios thinking about that, getting a patient to do a certain thing consistently for their own benefit is hard enough, let alone, you know, getting people in senior leadership positions to do things that perhaps aren't for their own benefit. So for me, a lot of the focus needs to be on the inflexible elements of the system that we can change or need to convince people to change or you know, lobby people to change, because I think that's what has the biggest impact. And it's things, you know, things that we have talked about. Well, actually, you know, how do we get rid of the impact of you know, implicit bias? Is it by giving everybody implicit bias training? Well, actually, there's not much evidence to say that really works. It's about stripping out the areas in which implicit bias can have an impact. So, you know, the application process should be blind. We shouldn't actually need to know loads of useless information about people when they're applying to jobs. It's only the really pertinent bits. Yes, do we need to try and make sure that panels are as diverse as possible, even if it means pulling people from other specialisms within hospitals to make sure that it's right, or people from different departments to make sure that it's as diverse as possible. Do we need to have Rooney type rules in certain circumstances to make sure that there are BAME people represented at all interviews, so at least there's one BAME applicant considered? These are the things that I think will make the impact, and these are policies, procedures. It's the rigid stuff, yeah. That I think there needs to be an equal focus on, because if you don't change that, people are going to do what they want to do, basically. There's too much flex within it. So it's not to say, we don't educate people and we don't support them and ask them to develop their sensitivity and awareness of these issues. But I think doing that without changing the system elements, the structural elements, I don't think we get the progress that we all want and we're all looking for. I think sort of for your sort of question around, is it suggestive of discrimination? I think was your starting question. I think that's an understatement. It's not suggestive of. It's hammering home that discrimination is there for all to see. And for me, it comes back to. And yes, some of this is not. It's not about just what the CSP is doing or what unis are doing. It is this whole societal thing. As in. Where we see issues in all walks of life or in a sort of micro environment, it's because it's representative of what's happening in the wider environment. And I think essentially what we're talking about is, discrimination that certain groups face within certain environments, and that's all about inequality. Discrimination, that sort of inequality is the output there. So whether it's for uni students, we're saying that you need a set of A-levels that actually you probably don't really need to do in a course. Well, actually, we know that the school, at primary and secondary school, fails certain groups of children. We know that already. So you're disadvantaged before you even got to considering filling in your UCAS form. We've talked about, panels not being diverse enough, applications not being blind. Well, again, you've got implicit bias, you've just allowed it to feed into the process. We know that, again, stories that I've heard from students, recently, we know that students are not getting the support that they need, and stuff that, I had to put up one with on placement, students are still putting up with on placement. So again, there's bias. It's not the support isn't culturally sensitive enough. We know that there's tons of data, the res data that's out there that just points to, the experience of Black, Asian and minority staff members in the NHS is just poorer than the experience of their white counterparts. They don't have the opportunities for book two to progress. They're less likely to access certain forms of training. They are more likely to experience bullying and racism. They're more likely to have conflict with their managers. We know similar things are kind of mirrored with sort of disability, our colleagues with disabilities as well, who are discriminated against and don't have similar opportunities. So I don't think we need to ask the question, are these things suggestive of discrimination? We know that it's there. We know that it's a big problem. I mean, it's about what we need to do to try and change it. And I said, for me, it's about the systems approach. It's about creating systems which don't allow people to allow people's biases to get in the way as much as they do currently.
Yeah, I think what's it called? I think you've actually quite answered a few of the questions I have instinctively, as I said, naturally. I think one of them was, I think we know that it is indicative of to an extent discrimination. But then if you're playing devil's advocate, is also, how do you toe the line if we're moving into the solution side? How do you toe the line between subjectivity and objectivity when you want to, for example, bring someone onto the course? Because at the same time, if you wanted to be fully objective and say you're only using the grades, but then is that equity? And then if you say you want to be too subjective, well, you might be, how we got here was because people were too subjective into saying this is what a regular physiotherapy should look like. How do you toe that line to get that fine balance? Because I can imagine it's not something you fix overnight. It's not something that, it's a bit of trial and error, but where do you start in a sense if we're moving forward now?
I think you've got to look at it from the other end, Farouk. So I think, you know, if we're saying that a lot of this is actually about making sure that we've got a workforce which is representative of the general population,
yeah,
and the population it serves, the question is how do we build a workforce that achieves that? And from that point, then you straight away need to go to removing any of the barriers that stop you from achieving that. And I don't think we've ever looked at it in that way. It's about filling places so you get funding, and if you've got lots of if you've got lots of people applying to courses, finding, you know, actually fairly simple ways of stripping that back. So for me, it's about, you know, if we know that we don't have the representation we need to meet the needs of the population we're serving, how do we address that? And we, you know, Manny, you talked about that sort of well-known equity, equality diagram, and who gets a box to stand on, and you know, that sort of stuff. And it's the final bit of that image. It's not giving people boxes. It's moving the fence. That is what you need to do. You need to get rid of the barriers that are there that stop people from doing it. So I think unis and the profession needs to really sit up and work out and come to a conclusion. You know, what does it want to look like? What is the makeup that we want, and how do we achieve that makeup? And I think until we use that as the starting point, I don't think you address it. You just end up in this ongoing cycle where,
yeah,
you know, as we've already discussed, things haven't changed over 20 years.
It just shows itself off in a different face. Repeats itself. And now moving to the next one, I think. Carry on, Rizzo.
If anything, I was just going to say, if anything, now I don't know of any stats, and maybe I'm just talking anecdotally, but as I was listening to that, I was just thinking about my East London University experience. And probably one of the things I could say about the University of East London was they took risks. My take on it was they took risks. They took people from, they were probably one of the first universities that I know of that took students from access courses. Yeah. And, you know, because, you know, 17 years ago or whatever it was basically you had to have A-levels, or you had a degree in something else, yeah, or, well, actually, access courses probably were just never thought about in most of the universities. But East London University, they took a lot of people from access to science evening courses. There was, and that's why we had so many mature students on the course, because they'd all gone through this access to science. So if we're talking about, you know, being equitable, well, maybe there is something around actually, not only in terms of the type of education, pre-registration education that we're willing to accept as a profession, bearing in mind, like we say, actually, do you need 3 A stars to be a physiotherapist? Arguably, you probably don't. Yeah. So, you know, changing that, but also as well, you know, the interviewing process. Well, maybe that process needs to be looked at. So it is much more multifaceted, as opposed to, you know, the interview I had was basically, I was on one side of a table and there was a panel of 3 people asking me questions, which is fine. It's very good if you've been schooled in how to answer questions, okay, yes, from a panel. Yeah. But if you haven't been schooled in that, you're going to do badly in it. There's no two ways about it. You are going to do badly in it because there is a knack to doing that. And most people who can answer questions like that tend to have been coached beforehand.
Yeah.
So that goes to Angie's point about mentoring. But actually, maybe you can reduce the need for mentoring by having a slightly different approach. You know, something like Google. You know, Google have a very novel approach to recruiting people. Very novel.
Can I just ask a question? Who would change that barrier? And I think, thanks for those points, amazing. In terms of that fence we were talking about, so you've talked about, Uzo, the difference and the change in way higher education institutions would interview people and the way that the profession would accept different candidates? Who would change those things?
Accountable.
Who'd change that? Who'd change all those things? So who would do it?
Well,
the CSP?
Actually, no. I mean, I think the example, the interesting thing about the university, and I keep going back to them,
yeah.
And the reason why I go back to them is because, you know, they were leading the way back then. And also, and you know what's really interesting? They lost their NHS contract about 10 years ago, okay, before it went to, you know, students pay for their fees. And part of the reason why they lost their NHS contract, I believe, you know, reading some of the stuff on ICSP, if it's to be believed, is because there was complaints about the quality of the student that they were taking through, okay? Mainly from people who were actually anonymous on ICSP. And what was really interesting was because the University of East London, they took risks because they took people from non-traditional backgrounds and they gave them a chance. And what was really fundamentally interesting was actually, if you look at how many consultant physiotherapists are there in the country? Well, Angie's one of them, and she went to the University of East London. Peter Rastaghini is another one.
Yep.
He went to the University of East London. You know, groundbreakers. You know, groundbreakers.
Dylan Morrissey, professor at QMW, year below me. You are so right. University of East London was forward-thinking. They took mature students. I know that my peers in other physiotherapy colleges 30 years ago were predominantly white, middle class, and a lot of them had parents that were already in medicine. You know, that was the UEL was just a standalone. And so the answer to your question about how do you change it, I think some of it has to come from the head of physiotherapy. So it's the department, the vice chancellors, but it's also driven by us pushing for that, but also showing them what they've gained. You know, why don't we just go back to UEL and say, you know what, guys, you thought out the box and you're a bit creative and you're a bit different, and look at what your payoff's given you.
In the same way that maybe Manchester United should bring back Alex Ferguson and ask them what the recipe was for that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm a bit of laughter here. I mean,
yeah.
Fundamentally, it makes me, what's going, like, ticking around in my head is who was there? Who was in UEL? That was one person. I'm telling you.
That was one person that made that brought it forward.
It was one person who was at the top, who was part of that decision-making process, who led that. It's one person. If you go back to UEL, you will find there is one person who was like the hot sauce to that main meal. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
It's one person. But they were board level. They were board level and they were watching it. They made it their duty, a bit like Dr. Melrose Stewart, to watch how this was changing. They studied this. And they will have known to a degree that there was always the risk that this was going to get shut down at some point. Maybe they didn't even think they were going to get as long as they got. You know, it'd be interesting to see UEL have an alumni event of some kind in and amongst physiotherapy. What would that look like?
Yeah.
Would they bring back some of the people that were vice chancellors, head of physiotherapy at that point? I think it's interesting. It'd be interesting to see who that was.
I think you're right. I think they're pioneers, aren't they? People who make the changes, whether that be the topic we're discussing now, but any big topic, there's always somebody, there's one individual who's just pioneered it, taking the risk, wanting to do it differently. And anybody could be that person. But we do need more of those people at senior levels.
Yeah, I think one of that's what we've hammered on this quite well, and I think we've done it quite well in the sense that you need someone to be disruptive and not to say, this is the way things have always been. Let's just carry on doing things the way they've always been. We need someone in that room to say, you know what, this is how things have always been. And it's not working, or something. There's something fundamentally wrong with the way we've been doing it multiple times. How can we change this thing to looking towards the future? How can we say then, okay, we're not seeing what we want to do. Take some risks. As Uzo said, they took risks and it's, to an extent, I can imagine it's paid off because it's probably brought light to multiple and many physiotherapists who are more than qualified, who were part of that quote unquote risk scheme, if you get what I mean. And it's not just saying that we're just going to carry on keeping it the way it has been going. So now if we're moving towards the future now, we've already met, I think we've answered multiple questions already at the lift. And if you're listening to this and you have any questions, feel free to just keep dropping them below. We may not get to everything now, but we will try and answer them either via Facebook comments, or we might take the conversation to Twitter and we might try our best to answer it.
I
know you've been answering. Yeah. I know Leanne has taken the initiative to be answering our questions, and we appreciate you for that.
I can do that because as things come up and I'm obviously processing what we're all saying, and I'm looking at, you know, in a timely way how people are asking certain things. And I think that Matthew Wyatt was really, you know, he wanted some solutions. And I started to say, well, actually, yeah, we touched on some of that, and this is what we're thinking. And he has come back, actually said he thinks the panel have nailed most of it. Really like the different plants needing different feed. Who was that? Was that Manny? For me, understanding and recognition, it is a complex issue requiring a complex and multifaceted system and solution. And I always said in my talks with the Chartered Society of Physio that what I didn't want was for it to be a situation of, okay, tell us what you think you need in order for us to make some change and for this to look and feel and be better. We say, right, we want these 10 things, please give them to us. And when those 10 things don't make the difference, then what? And that's why, you know, when Andrew sort of summarized some of the things I was saying in terms of this is a collective effort, it is. This is not about a group of people saying this is what we think needs to be done to make this look different. Sorry, I use my hands all the time. Not about, you know, a group of people saying, right, we want it to look like this, and the people on the opposing side saying, okay, we'll give you that then. This is about coming together to get those solutions to these are problems. And I don't know if when we come off here, whether people will end up with more questions, because as the more you're learning, you know, I felt like this when I was doing my master's, second me if you agree. But every time I learned something, it made me question something else. And I think I had cemented what I knew there. Hold on a minute, you know. And then every time a patient came in with that, you know, complaint. And I always use the analogy that as juniors, they always talked about the ankle sprain. Every time you talk to your friend, when you go for a physio job, they're going to ask you about how you manage an ankle sprain, you know, because it's like one of the easiest things to treat. And then I did my master's in foot and ankle.
Is it?
Right, exactly, exactly. You know, but they wanted to hear, didn't they, the, you know, protection, rest, ice, compression, elevation. But then do we start talking about, you know, well, actually, there's a shift on the talus and what happens to the ligament and what happens then to the forefoot and, you know, anterior ankle impingement. And, you know, the more you learn about a thing, the more that you learn that there are these layers, you know. I think that although we are working and pushing, I'm using that word pushing, in a direction because we want change, I don't know that we'll be coming off with all the solutions people might well be looking for. I think it is very...
I think also an important thing, Leanne, is that it's not as much as a group, and there's lots of other people who are pushing this forwards and raising awareness. I think to some degree we have to acknowledge the fact that it's not our responsibility to find the solutions. I think we need to participate in the discussion, guide, inform, suggest, collaborate, but the issues that we're talking about organizations not being diverse or inclusive or discrimination, that is not our problem as a group. We're affected by it, but actually it's the people who are in, you know, positions of power and influence, it's actually their problem which is causing us issues. So I think it's really important when we do have this conversation that actually I think sometimes, because I think, you know, I think everyone's articulate things really, really well, it sounds like we're the ones that need to fix it, but we don't need to fix it. It's not for us to fix as such. And I think that's a really important thing, because I think that's then what leads to people becoming overloaded, burnt out, asked to drive things, which actually, you know, it's not our sole responsibility. So yes, there's a vested interest in all of this stuff being improved for us. But those people out there who are listening to this, who are in positions of influence, you know, you guys need to drive this. And yeah, we'll sort of help the steering and help map things out. But we need people outside of, you know, the groups that we're talking about who are being affected, whether that be from an ethnicity perspective, whether it be from a gender perspective, from a sexual identity perspective, whatever we're talking about, it's not the people within those groups that are the issue here. They're the people that are being negatively affected. So I think that's really clear that if you're engaged with the things that people are talking about here and you want to make a difference, yes, listen, start that learning journey. You need to really care about it, but then actually you need to contribute to this as well. It can't be left for the people who are, and I use this term, I don't like the term, but the people who are the victims of it. You'd never in any circumstance of, a person who's a victim of something, someone who's the person that's negatively affected, expect them to be the ones to fix it. That's not, that's a real, and that's not, and not that any of us are playing a victim role or anything like that, but that's not how it works. So I think it's really important that if we're trying to engage people with these topics, that they understand this is a problem for everybody, to contribute to, and it's not something that needs to be on the shoulders of the people in this group or any other marginalized group.
Just one thing I think to add is it comes down to that inclusion. That word at the beginning, that inclusion, it's that element of having that now that we have the time to voice what has been going on and proactively engage. And that's my take on it as well, that, we have that element of being able to now say proactively, as a community, these are things that have happened. And this is how it's been for a very long time. And that's something that has affected us, and there needs to be systemic change to influence it. So yeah, I completely agree, it's from both sides, and agree with all the comments. It's definitely something that right now is pertinent.
I agree with everything, and I will say, being quite, we're all quite positive people, and I do think that actually we also have to be very willing to push the boat out ourselves as well. And whilst we do need systemic change, there's no two ways about it. That in itself, whether we like it or not, unfortunately, that is going to take time. And if we wait for the scraps to fall off the table, it's likely that we'll be waiting for a long time. Yeah. So actually, us taking responsibility as well, being role models, mentoring others, who are coming through, getting involved, with youth groups, schools, going to universities, and just really getting ourselves around, being on social media, podcasts, whatever. And this is not just us as a group that's currently on this chat. It's like, it's for everybody. It's for everybody. That is from a BAME background. Get out, make your own mark. And like I say, if you wait for the scraps to fall off the table, and you might be the only one for a little bit. Yeah. And that's okay. Okay. But don't wait for the scraps to fall off the table, because I think you'll be waiting for a very long time. And that's where frustration comes to the fore.
I think also one other thing I wanted to add was that ultimately, at the end of the day, we're going back to being a realistic step. There will be people who oppose fundamentally some of the things we are discussing, some of the things we're trying to implement, and the change we are going through. It's very natural on all sides. If you're talking about war, I don't know why we use war, but there will be one side and there will be the other side. Now, as uplifting, as positive, and as progressive as we all sound, there are people in multiple, either higher positions, lower positions, mid positions, that don't really support what we're saying, or they don't disagree with what we're saying. They think that, because I remember I've seen a few Twitter threads where people are saying that, all the opportunities are distributed equally, and it's not a matter of race, or it's not a matter of ethnicity. And there are people who think like this in these positions of power. So my question actually is, how do we, as we are trying to push, as Liana said, as we're trying to fight, break these barriers that have been set up, some of these have been set up intentionally, some without thinking, people, it's just been a way of thinking. How do we fight against, for lack of a better word, how do we push back against these people and these organizations who are fundamentally opposed to the way we are thinking, the way, the goal we want to get to, when we want a more diverse or more to more inclusive physiotherapy. How do we go about that?
Can I take that one?
Andrew can have the second talk. Second point.
Go on, the answer Andrew. Might be better anyway.
I think because this question has come up before. The first thing is, there will always be people. You can't be everyone's cup of tea. So you a part of you has to accept that there are going to be some people who love what you do. Some people are going to hate it. Some people are going to feel absolutely indifferent. Okay, that's the first thing. My second thing is, those people that have been or are opposing the need for change in these circumstances, this isn't just within physiotherapy, this is within society in itself, now is not their time. They've been heard. Things have stayed the same for a very long time. Right. And actually, I'm less concerned about those people. They mean very little to this as a movement in general. They don't mean very much. And when my sister and I were interviewed on the One Show, this was about a pub that was called the Black, and is still called the Black Boy, and talking about changing the name. My sister said to the landlord, she said, if you do have people that are opposing the change of the name, and you say that you are so open to what in technical terms was diversity and inclusion, do you really want those people that are opposing? Do you want them in your pub? It's the same. Those that are opposing some of this as a movement, do we want them to remain within physiotherapy, or are they part of the fundamental problem in the first place? So that's my answer to your question.
Brilliant. Andrew, do you have anything to add to that? I think that's a brilliant answer.
Yeah, I think my answer was going to be similar. I mean, to be honest with you, I wouldn't waste my time on that, really. I think I've learned with other things, you pick your winners and you pick the people that want to change. And when you find those individuals and they start changing and things look better and things get better, it's really interesting to observe then how other people start to follow. So maybe it's because I'm getting old, but I don't have the energy to be trying to change people, like Leanne said, who are set. We know, you know, if they're not wise up to it now, then I really don't think anyone can help, to be honest with you. I think our energies go to the people who want to see change, who are going to help us to make that change and can see it's important.
Great.
That's brilliant. That's a very brilliant answer. And I think,
can I also just say, fundamentally, and we mustn't forget this, right? This is all about, it's not just about us as physios, it's also about the benefit of what this diversity and inclusion does for our patients. You know, they are at the other end. My patients won't necessarily know about the difficulties that I've had or the things I've sustained to be where I am now. They're not the things that I talk to my patients about. Like, you know, if I walked around with some kind of chip on my shoulder, I wouldn't be able to have sustained a business for the last 5 years. And actually, the who I am is something I think that most of my patients embrace wholly. And the who I am is coming from my culture. You know, I'm West Indian. We love to eat together. We love to chat together. That sense of belonging is something that I stand wholeheartedly behind. I don't have to make an effort to be that for my patients. And I know for a fact that so many of them, of my patients, embrace that within what I do. What I sometimes felt was within the NHS, that essence of who I was being lost. I wasn't allowed to get into that. I could ask my patients first 20 minutes of the subjective assessment. I'm asking them all about them, but they can't ask me about me. I'm asking them all about them, I want to know if they're married. I want to know if they have kids. I want to know what they do for work. I know everything about that person, their medical health. And then, do you know what? I get them to take their clothes off as well. I mean, there's got to be something about what we're doing here as a movement within physiotherapy that makes our patients feel safe and that they're in a place that is fair for them and that they're going to be heard, listened to, and completely understood. And if we've not got that diversity and inclusion at the top, how are our patients, how are we going to see more Black patients? Because I don't see lots of Black patients. How are we going to see them when they don't know that that's also open for them too? Does that make sense?
I think that's very brilliant. And I think one of the last questions I'll ask is, which I think is a very, very important question, and I think everyone here probably have either similar or answers. What does it mean for our patients? I think Leanne has touched on that very, very deeply. What does it actually mean? Why is this important? Not just for ourselves, but to the people we're providing the care for. Why does all this matter to them? Should they even care about this? Should this even be an issue? Is this just amongst us, or is this for them? I'll start with Ishmael, if you have any remarks on that.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the first question around what's the value, what's the benefit of diversity, and I think diversity and inclusion means that we're able to better meet the needs of our patients, offer better services, offer care which is the best. So if we're not actually pulling from a wide enough pool to make sure that we've got the best people entering the profession, we're failing our patients, basically. It's as simple as that. And I think one of the real things is that if we're talking about physiotherapy as a profession, we should have the tools to do this, to make this work. Physio is about communicating effectively. It's about engaging people with an idea. It's about getting plans in place. It's about setting goals. This is all the stuff that we say we're good at from in terms of a clinical perspective and kind of what we want to achieve with our patients. Well, actually all of those skills are the things that we're talking about we need to drive change from a diversity and inclusion perspective. So I think it's hugely important for our patients. Brilliant. I think without us doing this, we're not going to be able to offer them the best service that we can.
Yeah. Does anyone else want to add anything to that regarding what it means to our patients, what we have with that?
I was just going to say that, we know now with a lot of what we're doing is that we have to use a sort of biopsychosocial model. And a lot of this is understanding people's belief systems, where they're coming from, how they understand the problem, their own health behaviours. So having a more diverse group of people who are delivering the care, it helps us to better understand the patients who are coming to us. So the more we have people of diverse backgrounds asking the questions, we ask the right questions, we understand where they're coming from. For my undergraduate dissertation, I looked at whether there were cultural differences and whether it impacted on patients' care in Newham and in Tower Hamlets. Uzo will know that that's a big Bangladeshi population. And what we found in that project when we surveyed physios was that to some degree, the more you're exposed to people of a certain ethnic group, the better you understand them and the better you could relate to them. And actually that then translated in, so Tower Hamlets, there was things translated into Bengali. They have signs and they improved the health of that population group. So I think some of this is about us exposing ourselves, but Leanne makes a good point. The problem to start with is these people aren't even accessing services because they don't know what physiotherapy is, or they don't see where physiotherapy fits in. So diversity has to cross all channels. It's got to be us in the profession, but we've also got to get out there and tell our patients and make the patients understand their beliefs and where they're coming from. Because COVID has brought that to light. It is an absolute tragedy that we have seen so many Black and ethnic minorities dying as a result of COVID disproportionately. And that is because of health inequalities that still exist in our health system. There shouldn't be a debate here, guys. This has got to change. Diversity is important in all those elements.
Yeah. I think that's...
Sorry. Farouk, that said inequality, Andrew, is the same reason that your parents would say, why would you choose to do physiotherapy? It's the same, you know? When I was going to do physiotherapy, my dad was like, well, why aren't you going to do law? Or why aren't you going to... It's, you know, they... How can they encourage you to do something that they know nothing about? I don't know how much you will be paid. I don't know if this is stable. I don't know... Nothing. My push into physiotherapy was through my grandmother, who was an orthopedic staff nurse. And I wrote about that specifically in my... In the frontline journal. And the reason why I spoke about her more than anything else was because this wasn't my mom or dad. This was my grandmother telling me about this job that she felt that I would be good at. She had insight. She knew about the potential for stability. She knew about the potential for travel. She knew about how dynamic it was. And she knew if she could educate me about it, I would be curious enough to look into it. You know, the true measure of, for most successful people, is that curiosity. You know, my grandmother was very successful as a nurse. You know, she taught students. She would have been in those universities and she will have seen those students from universities who were coming from different backgrounds, recognizing who was coming in as a physiotherapist, who was coming in as a nurse, working in those multidisciplinary teams. This was a woman ahead of her time, without a shadow of a doubt. But that said lack of diversity and inclusion is exactly the reason why your parents are saying, don't do that. Why would you? What makes you think of that? We don't know about it. And before you can have the opportunity to educate them, they're shut. You're being shut down. And you are saying to us 30 odd years later that your parents are proud. But you've had to work for that, Andrew. And I wholeheartedly stand beside you and understand that from the bottom of my heart, because I know what it's like to drive that approval. I understand what that's like. And I stand with you as a woman from an ethnic background. I stand with you because I know it. And it's not, you know, what people must understand. And when we talk about this, all of us that stand on this panel, and I've said this before, we all come from families. We have the toxic people who tell you don't do it. We have the ones that are all there from a place of love, but the way that they say it doesn't come across correctly. And we're young and naive, and we don't have a book that's telling us how to do it or guide us. People like Andrew and myself, we've taken a risk. So what you see now in front of you, and it's not been one risk, it's been several risks that have us sat here in front of you. It's not one risk. It's so many risks. I could write a book with Andrew and we would never finish. We would never finish. You know, and if we had to pick them all away, I wouldn't be here sat talking to Farouk with Uzo or Manny or Ishmael, because I wouldn't be confident and I wouldn't be able to have this conversation here with you now, because I'd be living back in my anxiety world with a lack of confidence and a low self-esteem. This is where we are now. I'm saying it openly. This is brave. The decisions that I made to build a business at a time when I did was brave, and I know that. But you know, I am all the time driven by the same family that said, why would you do that? Is that okay? And I'm driven by the patients, you know, the satisfaction behind the job that I do, physiotherapy, and I stand by it now, is very credible, and I thoroughly enjoy what I do. When we start to embrace more diversity and more inclusion, I want to raise the roof on what this will look like. I want to raise the roof on what this will really look like. There will be floods of all people wanting to join this profession. You know, there was a quote by Martin Luther King. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. I'll say it again.
Yeah.
Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter.
Brilliant.
I'm just so pleased not to be silent anymore.
Thank you very much, Leanne, for those powerful words. Thank you very much for those powerful words. I think that is a very, very great way to end the conversation. I don't know if Manny or Izzo, do you have anything else to say, or you want to end it there? Really, I think Leanne has set it all for us.
And drop really, the mic moment.
That's it. It's a drop the mic moment. Now, for those who are listening, if you want to carry on the conversation, if you want to ask anybody specific questions, you can look at the Physio Matters podcast on Twitter, and you will see everybody's Twitter bio and handle. So you can feel free to ask direct questions or just ask the Physio Matters podcast questions, and we'll be sure to reciprocate that to the appropriate people. But thank you all for coming to this live. We hope we've actually been able to make a difference. And I think we have. I definitely all made a difference in my life, definitely. And I've started to see things from a whole new perspective already. And I think, because I do enjoy my job as a young physiotherapist, and I know I'll continue to enjoy it. So thank you all again for coming on the panel. I really appreciate you all being here. Mm-hmm. And till next time.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Farouk.
Thank you for organizing it. It was brilliant.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Have a lovely day. See you later, guys.
Thank you. See you later. Bye-bye.